You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Good morning, friend. Welcome into the Mike Allen Show here on this Monday, April 3rd. We are finally getting into spring, which is nice indeed. Hopefully it will be where you are anyway. It's spring break here locally in the public schools in Lexington, Kentucky, where we broadcast from. Maybe a week late for some of you. Maybe you had spring break last week. But regardless, my pleasure to be with you. We're going to have a guest here in about 15 minutes. She's Eliza Lever, a young woman who has clinched scoring the most points in the Bracketology with Father Bronner contest. Now, that doesn't guarantee her the top prize. The top prize, which we made a shift. It's now a free pizza a week for a year from Little Caesars, thanks to our friends in the Central Kentucky, with the Central Kentucky Little Caesars. But she'll get the most slips of paper in the hat. It's like the NBA lottery. And so if everybody who beats Father Bronner, and this year looks like a pretty good number of people have defeated Father, because when his bracket croaked and he ended up with zero teams in the Final Four, then it kind of opened the door wide for some other people. But basically, depending on where you place above Father Bronner, it will determine how many slips of paper that you get in the drawing. But Eliza's got it clinched because even those who picked North Carolina to win tonight, I think her dad actually would be the next person who has the next chance to beat her. If North Carolina wins tonight, he'll end up with 81 points, still short of her 83. And Ida, who's in second place with 77 points, also picked Gonzaga tonight. By the way, it is Gonzaga. I finally got that clarified. Even though in Italy, the Saint Aloysius Gonzaga is how it'd be pronounced. For whatever reason, in the Pacific Northwest, the name of the school, they pronounce Gonzaga. After all, they're sometimes called the Zags. So make sure you get that right. But anyway, Ida also picking Gonzaga, so she can't gain on Eliza. So, boy, I hope Eliza's pick is right. A sixth championship for the Tar Heels is a little bit tough for me to take. Anyway, so we'll have her on in about 13 minutes, live from her own spring break in Crystal River, Florida. She'll give us her own bracket picking strategies. Maybe we can follow them next year. I'm not bad. I'm tied for fourth, which is pretty good for me, though my national champion, Kentucky, went out in the Elite Eight. So anyway, we'll talk about that a little bit today. We'll talk about the readings, remembering that who Jesus defends, which makes the news of the New Testament even better than the old. Why Jesus needed more than me time. An interesting article from Father Jim Martin, a Jesuit, in CNN, and we'll talk about the saint of tonight's title game, St. Aloysius Gonzaga, and trying to remember what serves what. We'll get into all that today. My question of the day, it's Eddie Murphy's birthday. Now, I know all that Eddie Murphy has done over the years has not always been family friendly, but I think we even with that in mind, have to admit the man has immense talents in terms of as a character actor in particular, whether that's in live film or in animation, the voice of the donkey in Shrek or the little dragon in Mulan. So what would you say has been Eddie Murphy's best character or role? Whether it's a movie, whether it's a skit, you know, he was first well known for being a member of the Saturday Night Live cast, like a lot of comedic actors. So if you want to chime in on that, 573-4BREAD-4, 573-4BREAD-4, or you can email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com, or you can post a thought on Facebook or on Twitter. I hope you've had a good weekend. I did a little binge watching this weekend. There have been only two different shows in the history of television. Now, binge watching has not always been possible for the most part, but particularly with the rise of networks like Netflix and Hulu and so forth, it's become more possible. My only other binge watch experience was with Breaking Bad, the Vince Gilligan production that I watched that told the story of Walter White, the chemistry teacher who, after a diagnosis with cancer, begins to make and to sell crystal meth as a means of paying for his treatments and leaving his family something after he's gone, and he descends into this underworld, not only of darkness around him, but darkness within him. It's a brilliant show. It's not for the faint of heart. Well, Vince Gilligan has another show, the prequel, Better Call Saul, which focuses in on the sort of shyster attorney from Breaking Bad, Saul Goodman, a.k.a. Jimmy McGill. And Better Call Saul is telling the story of how this character came to be. And I got a good my good friend Jason Hall, who's a regular on the program, says that we're living in the golden age of television in many ways, and that television has really begun to tap in to something it can do that the silver screen cannot, and that is, over time, really develop characters. And I will say that this is something that I think that Vince Gilligan, this director of Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul, does so well. There have now been 20 episodes of Better Call Saul. Season 2 finally came on Netflix, so I watched all 10 episodes of that in about the last 4 or 5 days. And great, great show. Lots of moral complexity to the program. Maybe the descent into darkness isn't as steep as it is in Breaking Bad, but you do see definitely moral compromises, and how moral compromises, number one, how they often begin with the best of intentions, and how easily we can rationalize our sort of squishiness around the edges when it comes to our moral principles. It also illustrates the implications and ramifications of our choices that oftentimes go far beyond what we originally intended. And one other thing I think this show does, if you've not watched it, really, really good. Old Lenny from Lenny and Squiggy fame, back, Michael McKean. Of course, he's been in some other shows as well, but plays the lawyer Jimmy McGill, a.k.a. Saul Goodman, plays his brother, a much more successful attorney, much smarter, and yet not nearly as likable as Jimmy McGill, who would later become Saul Goodman. Now, his brother Chuck, brilliant lawyer, partner in this massive firm, knows the law back and forth, but he's just not that likable. And it drives him crazy that people just tend to like his brother, even though his brother violates every lawyerly ethic that you could imagine. I'm telling you, it's fascinating. So that's my endorsement for Better Call Saul. If you've not yet seen it, you need to watch it. It really tells the story both of Saul Goodman or Jimmy McGill, and at a parallel, at the same time, in a parallel way, tells the story of another guy, character that I love, Mike Ehrmantraut. So check it out. Really, really good. Anyway, the readings for today. The first one is from the book of Daniel, chapter 13. It's a passage actually not in Protestant Bibles. So not only do you have the seven books that are called by Catholics the Deuterocanonicals, that were part of the Greek Septuagint of the Old Testament, but that Protestants reject. Right? Please don't ever buy the old saw that you hear thrown out, that we Catholics added books. They were there in the Septuagint, which is the Bible that Jesus himself read, actually. The books were taken out by Martin Luther, and those weren't, by the way, the only ones he wanted to take out, but I digress. Anyway, but it's not just those seven books that make the difference between a Catholic Bible and a Protestant Bible. There are aspects of some books, like in the book of Daniel, portions of the book of Daniel that were in the Greek Septuagint that were maybe not in the original Hebrew, that we consider canonical and Protestants do not, and includes this story of the God-fearing woman who also happened to be very beautiful, Susanna. Susanna, who goes out into her husband's garden for a walk along with two maidens. But she dismisses the maidens, and she so that she can bathe. She sends them to bring oil and soap. And of course, she gets into the water and begins to bathe herself. Two old men, two creeps, basically got up and hurried to her, elders among the people, and they asked her to lie with them and said, if you don't, we'll concoct a story about you, that you dismissed your maids because a young man was here with you. Susanna would not yield to their advances, and she cried out, and in rushed the people and found Susanna there naked and heard the accusations of the old men. And, of course, particularly in that day, a woman's testimony was not valued. And so Susanna, despite her protestations of innocence, was slated to be executed for taking a lover, an adulterous lover. We'll pick this back up on the other side of the break. It's interesting what happens, how she's rescued. But then in parallel with the gospel reading, who is it also that the Lord defends? Good news for you and me. We'll be back. This is the Mike Allen Show. You're listening to Breadbox Media.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
Fifteen minutes past the hour, you're back on the Mike Allen Show here on this Monday, April 3rd. We have on the phone, live from her spring break in beautiful Crystal River, Florida, Eliza Lever. Eliza, who has clinched having the highest point total in the Bracketology with Father Bronner contest, and that means she'll get the most slips of paper in our drawing for a free pizza a week for a year. Really taking one for the team, getting up early. Good morning, Eliza.
Good morning.
Wow, spring break, and your dad gets you up at 7 a.m.
Yeah.
Not bad, though. So you're in Crystal River, Florida. Tell me what that's like.
Well, we're not going to be here for the whole trip, but it's the city of the manatees, so we went swimming with manatees, and that was pretty fun.
Wow, were you worried about alligators at all?
Not really, but I don't want to see one.
were the manatees fairly friendly, easygoing?
Yeah, they're really friendly. It took us a while to see one, but when one came up, it rolled over for a belly rub.
Seriously, that is really, really cool. All right. Well, listen, you as you know, you beat your old man in the Bracketology with Father Bronner contest, so... I hope you're going to give him a hard time about that.
Well, I usually beat him like every year. So,
so it's no biggie. Well, one thing that you and your father both did, now I'm not sure whether it was because of your basketball brilliance or because of your Badger loyalties, but you did pick Wisconsin to go farther than most people. In fact, you picked their big upset over Villanova. So what was your secret there?
I don't know. I just kind of like Wisconsin, so
sure.
I just picked them.
Well, your dad said you had I was looking at your bracket, and you, of course, you actually picked the final game tonight. You've got Gonzaga
versus North Carolina. You still like the Zags' chances tonight?
Yeah, I think so. Their mascot's a bulldog, and I like bulldogs. So
is that, you know, your dad said you had a special picking strategy. Was mascot preference part of it?
Yeah, that was the main part. There was also consideration of, like, names and team colors and, like, you know, a little bit of basketball.
So you pick, like, so for example, okay, you got to North Carolina versus Kentucky. Mm-hmm. And, you know, by the way, the South region, except for Wichita State's win over Dayton, you picked Dayton. You got every other game right, which is pretty impressive, honestly. And you had Kentucky, North Carolina in the final game. Of course, now this is where I messed up. I picked Kentucky because I went with loyalty, being a Cat fan. You picked the Tar Heels. Did you have a criteria there?
Well, I'm not a huge Kentucky fan. And also, so I was picking by the mascot there. And the Tar Heels are like the Southerners who like fought in the war or something. So I figured, you know, a Southern guy with a gun could shoot up a Wildcat.
Oh, I see. So now you've got a bulldog. How do you take it that a bulldog beats somebody with a gun?
Well, that one I had a lot of trouble with. I wasn't sure who to pick. I liked the color of the Tar Heels, but, you know, I like bulldogs. So I figured that I should just go with bulldogs because I like them.
Well, I'm glad you did because I have to be honest, Eliza. Tar Heel blue makes me nauseous. So I don't share the same perspective on the baby blue as you do. Well, that's fantastic. So how old are you, Eliza?
I'm 14.
14. Wow. Well, any career goals already at 14?
I'm not really sure, but I do ballet, so I think I might want to do something like that. Or I might want to work in the Disney parks and be like a princess or something, but I don't know if that's going to happen.
And maybe have a little, you know, a little side gambling business on college basketball?
Not
that we're encouraging that, mind you, but maybe I'll call you next year when I make out my bracket. And we'll figure it out. So, you know, you have a decent chance of winning a free pizza a week for a year. That's pretty good.
Yeah. I mean, I don't really need to eat a pizza every week, but, you know.
You could turn that over to your dad, maybe, you know.
Yeah.
He'd appreciate that. Yeah. Pizza a week and ballet don't usually go together.
Yeah.
I would imagine. So, good. So, what else are you doing on your trip?
I'm not really sure. Our parents are making it a surprise, so.
That's awesome. Wow. So, so you get to swim with the manatees. Is it gorgeous? I mean, it's got to be gorgeous.
Yeah, it's pretty hot, but it's nice.
Wow. Well, don't complain too much. I mean, you're in Florida, for heaven's sake, so. All right, so we'll pay attention to your picks, and how about, so y'all down there in Crystal River, do they have any Catholic churches down there?
Yeah, we went to one. It was like St. Benedict's.
Oh, cool. Was it pretty well crowded?
Yeah, it was pretty crowded. It was kind of a weird service, but.
Well, you'll find those every once in a while. Well, Eliza, thanks for taking time to be with us, and I hope you have a nice breakfast. Are y'all leaving out from Crystal River today?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. Well, good. Well, glad you got to enjoy the manatees and glad no gators got you. And watch out for those Burmese pythons and go Zags.
Yep.
All right. Well, hopefully you'll have a good chance to win. So take care. All right.
Okay. Thank you.
All right.
Bye.
Fantastic. Yeah, that's Eliza Lever, who scored big on the Bracketology with Father Bronner contest. In fact, I'm looking at the standings. I actually think I posted these on Facebook, actually. And, Eliza's got the most points with 83, which means even if somebody gets the final game right, there's nobody that can catch her. And then after that, I think comes Ida with 76 points. Let me see if I can pull this up, the standings, and look at it here. Yeah, then you've got Ida with 76, and then Jill with 74. Eliza's dad, Mark, with 71, and then Alex, who runs the board here, with 68. And if North Carolina wins tonight, now Mark and Alex will both jump up And they will finish in second and third place, respectively. So they'll have a good chance too at the free pizza. So I was looking at the, you know, we got a Catholic school in the finals tonight, Gonzaga against North Carolina, and Gonzaga could become the 10th Catholic school national champ in the history of the NCAA tournament. Out of the 70, I think this will be the 79th NCAA tournament, I believe. So you got, 79th. So you've got the 10 prior ones, Holy Cross, LaSalle, San Francisco, who won in back-to-back years with a little bit of the help of a guy named Bill Russell. You've got Loyola of Chicago, who won, I think, in several overtimes against Cincinnati back in the early 60s. You've got Marquette in Al McGuire's last collegiate game. You've got the Georgetown Hoyas, who won in 84 and then lost in 85 to the winner of the last two Catholic school national championships, and that's Villanova, who won in 85. I was there, by the way. That was the year you had three Catholic schools in the Final Four. You had Villanova, St. John's, and Georgetown, and then little old Memphis. And then Villanova, of course, won it again last year. Now, you've also had, looks like, nine, I think, runner-ups. So right now, Catholic schools in the final game are an even 9-9, so it's up to the Zags tonight to make it 10-9. So you've got Seton Hall, who's been to the finals. Georgetown, who's been to the finals three different times, one time back in the 40s, and then also a couple of, I mean, three times in which they've lost. They also went the one time they won. Marquette, who's been to the finals another time and lost. Villanova's lost once. Dayton, the Dayton Flyers. LaSalle has lost, and St. John's has lost. So Catholic schools fairly well represented. Now, what's amazing is when you start looking at Catholic schools that have never been to the final game, for example, you know, the most, probably the most prominent Catholic school in the United States with the proudest sports tradition of them all, Notre Dame. Notre Dame's only been to one Final Four. That was almost 40 years ago, 1978. They've knocked on the door a few times, including against my Kentucky Wildcats a couple of years ago in a game they probably should have won. But that's amazing to me. Boston College, I don't think, has ever been there. Xavier's never been to the Final Four. And then you've had a few who've been to the Final Four but never to the final game. So this will be Gonzaga's not only first appearance in the Final Four but also in the final game. Jesuit school from out in California. I was doing a little bit of reading about St. Aloysius Gonzaga. Gonzaga, he's pronounced in Italy, but they call the school Gonzaga. Hopefully that's not an indication of how far they've drifted from their Catholic roots. But St. Aloysius Gonzaga, a saint worth learning about, because he was somebody who was born into great privilege back in 16th century Italy and surrounded with some of the finer things, but it was also a lax, morally careless, self-indulgent age. But he himself was turned off by that and drawn, really, desired to be a saint. He desired to be holy. And it ended up having actually to be talked down from his severe self-denial and self-flagellation, basically, by entering into the orders. A great quote from him, though. After he entered the religious order of the Jesuits, he said, "I'm a piece of twisted iron. I entered the religious life to get twisted straight." That's pretty good. St. Aloysius Gonzaga, pray for us, and go Zags tonight. We'll be back with more. This is the Mike Allen Show. You're listening to Breadbox Media.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
right at the bottom of the hour, back on the Mike Allen Show here on Breadbox Media. Want to learn more about what we do? Go to breadboxmedia.com. Check out all of our various contributors, both during our weekday, daily shows, also our weekend contributors from every corner of this country and across the heartland. Check it all out at breadboxmedia.com and tell your friends about it. Get the app for your smartphone. You'll always have Breadbox Media with you in your pocket. Question of the day, on the actor's 56th birthday, what is Eddie Murphy's best role in a movie or a skit? You may remember some of his from the early Saturday Night Live days, whether it's Gumby, Mr. Robinson, as in Mr. Robinson's Neighborhood. A great photo I came across online, by the way, of he and Mr. Rogers together. The late Fred Rogers with a great sense of humor, obviously. Also, Buckwheat. and then, of course, there have been some of his animated characters, like his turn as the donkey on Shrek. Hilarious. And also the little dragon on Mulan, which is a movie I still have not seen. My kids still give me a hard time about that. And then, of course, he's had these movies, multiple movies, where he's played multiple characters in the same film. And a couple of you mentioned Coming to America, Prince Akeem and all his roles in that movie. That's the one, I think, with Arsenio Hall in it as well. Certainly though not always family friendly, in the Nutty Professor movies, where he plays the entire Klump family. That one scene, I think it's in the second one, where they're at the they're at the Golden Corral type place. Kind of a guilty pleasure, I guess. Very, very talented. Anyway, something else happened over the weekend yesterday, the anniversary of the death of Pope St. John Paul II, April 2nd, back in 2005. I remember where I was. It's one of those historical occasions where I remember exactly where I was, standing in our den in the parsonage of the Methodist Church where we were living at the time. We were counting down our last days there as the Methodist pastor and in that parsonage before entering the Catholic Church just a few months later. And I remember Pope St. John Paul II's life and witness. It had such an influence on me and my wife in drawing us to the Catholic Church, particularly after I read his biography by George Weigel called Witness to Hope. I remember reading about that and reading a hymn. It's a huge book. It took me months to read, but continued to be blown away as I read it, saying, what kind of a church produces people like this? It's amazing. Because as an evangelical Protestant for many years, I had admired Pope St. John Paul II from a distance, as I had, let's say, Mother Teresa. But as I look back, it's almost laughable now, but in my mind, it was as though I saw Pope St. John Paul II, his courageous witness against the utilitarian machinery of Eastern communism. I saw his stand against that and also his stand for the sanctity of human life, and I always thought he was an authentic Christian in spite of his Catholicism. Only later would I discover it was precisely because of his Catholicism. Now, I guess you can take that the other way, too, because there's certainly been plenty of scoundrels throughout history who have been Catholic, and you could say, what kind of church produces people like that? Like an Adolf Hitler, for example. But I guess that puts the onus on us and the freedom we've been given. What kind of life do we want to live that when people say, what kind of church produces people like that, how will they mean it? Anyway, but I remember standing there watching the television as the news of his death broke across the screen and all those gathered in candlelight vigil outside his window when people knew he was gravely ill and the word came out and I wept. Some of it was for gratitude for what he had meant to me, but there was also some sadness because I knew I was not yet in full communion of the church, in the bosom of the church, and I'd always wanted him to be my pope too. But what I came to realize, of course, after I came to really love
Pope Benedict XVI and now love Pope Francis, each with their own gifts and strengths and fatherly way. But what I discovered is that he will always be my Pope as well. And the beautiful thing of him being canonized and being a saint is that I know I have his prayers. Some ways, you know, it's like Jesus said the night before he died in John's gospel, it's better for you if I go away. It's how much greater are his prayers now than they were here on earth. So pray for us, Pope St. John Paul II. Anyway, back to the readings for today. As I said, the first one taken from the book of Daniel, the story of Susanna, a story that's not in Protestant Bibles, but it's included in the Catholic canon. Susanna, who was falsely accused of having an adulterous affair in a garden by two men who had approached her bathing and asking her to lie with them, which she refused, and then found herself accused and really convicted without a trial. And in the midst of this, in the midst of her false accusations, through tears, it said, she looked up to heaven, for she trusted in the Lord wholeheartedly, even as the elders made the accusation against her. And she cries aloud, it records her prayer. O eternal God, you know what is hidden and are aware of all things before they come to be. You know that they have testified falsely against me. Here I am about to die, though I have done none of the things with which these wicked men have charged me. And the Lord heard her prayer, and as she was being led to execution, he stirred up the Holy Spirit of a young boy named Daniel. And he cried aloud, I will have no part in the death of this woman. All the people turned and asked him, what is this you're saying? He stood in their midst and continued, are you such fools, O children of Israel, to condemn a woman without examination and without clear evidence? Return to court, for they have testified falsely against her. They all returned in haste, and then Daniel came up with a great plan. Not unlike probably many school principals or teachers have done, they separate the scoundrels and ask each of them, without them consulting with each other, under what sort of tree did you see Susanna and her alleged adulterous lover? And one said a mastic tree, and the other said under an oak. And then Daniel replied, your fine lie has cost you your head, for the angel of God waits with a sword to cut you in two so as to make an end of you both. And so these two who had hoped to put Susanna to death for her rejection of their advances found themselves executed. It's sort of that irony like happens in the book of Esther when the accuser or the one who wanted to destroy Mordecai and the Jews finds himself hung on the gibbet he himself had created. So you have that beautiful example of someone speaking up in defense of the innocent and those about to suffer unjustly. But then you parallel that with the gospel reading. We've already seen in the gospels how Jesus is like a new Moses, though greater, or Jesus is like, in John's gospel, he's like Abraham, but greater. And now we see Jesus even greater than Daniel, because Jesus is in the temple area and they bring to him, the scribes and the Pharisees, a woman caught in the act of adultery. Interesting, no mention of the man. Takes two to tango, as they say. But they bring the woman caught in adultery, make her stand in the middle, and they're going to test Jesus. Teacher, this woman was caught in the very act of committing adultery. In the law, Moses commanded us to stone such women. What do you say? They said this to test him, so they could bring some charge against him. Jesus bent down and began to write on the ground with his finger. That's interesting. It's the only occasion we have in the Gospels of Jesus writing anything. And it's remained a mystery for 2,000 years of what he began to write. There's been all sorts of speculation. to me, I see perhaps a connection here with the Ten Commandments, which were, according to the books of Moses, written by the very finger of God. Is it as though Jesus is making clear that the law, that the finger of God who wrote the law exists somehow in himself? We'll never know, though, of course. Anyway, Jesus says this great line, "Let the one among you who is without sin be the first to throw a stone at her." And of course, they all leave. But here's the thing. And then Jesus says to the woman, "Neither do I condemn you. Go, and from now on, do not sin anymore." What makes Jesus even greater? And what's good news for us is not simply that he defends the innocent, as Daniel did. Jesus stands up for the guilty. I mean, the passage makes no pretense of her being innocent at all. Jesus himself knows her guilt. And yet he stands in defense of her and for mercy anyway. Now, none of us could pick up a stone, which means we're guilty too. But we have an advocate, not only someone who has stood in our defense, but has shed his own blood for our guilt. That's the gospel. We come back a little bit more about Jesus, why he needed more than me time, with apologies to Father James Martin. This is the Mike Allen Show. You're listening to Breadbox Media.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Minutes before the hour, you're back on the Mike Allen Show.
Got a great message here from Lindsay. We were talking about the death of Pope St. John Paul II and where you were when it happened 12 years ago yesterday. And Lindsay has a very easy reminder of the passing of the great saint. She says, "Just listening to your show about remembering where you were when Pope John Paul II passed away, that is one I can never forget, as he passed away as my husband and I said our wedding vows." Wow. I guess happy anniversary is in order, too. "As our ceremony ended, strangers poured into the church to pray, and they hung black curtains over the doors of the church. It took me a while to realize it was a good thing. We said, 'I do,' as he entered the gates of heaven." No doubt, you got a great advocate and saint, Lindsay, for your marriage and for your family. As Pope St. John Paul II liked to say, the future of civilization passes by way of the family. And of course, the great gift he's given us in his theology of the body and our understanding of the marital meaning of the Christian experience. And that all earthly marriage points ultimately to our destiny to be the bride of the bridegroom, Jesus himself, who gave his very body for his beloved, the church. Oh, wow, what a great gift. So again, blessings to you, Lindsay, and to your family, and a happy anniversary indeed. If you want to chime in on our question of the day, Eddie Murphy's birthday is 56. What's your favorite character? What do you think is his best role in a movie or a skit? I doubt any of you are going to say his album. What was it? "My girl wants to party all the time, party all the time." Oh, one of many musical artists, actors who've tried to make their way into a musical career. Who'll ever forget Patrick Swayze's "She's Like the Wind Through My Trees"? David Soul. I'm really going back now. Don't give up on us, baby. So back to, we were talking about our Lord defending the, not just the innocent, but defending the guilty. In fact, giving his life for the guilty. What does it say in Romans? Very rarely would someone die For a righteous man, though, for a good man, someone would dare to die. But God demonstrates his own love for us in this: while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. Of course, we're in that time of the year where you're going to see stories about Jesus pop up on secular news sources. Oftentimes, quite frankly, they're stories that are meant to debunk or to undermine faith in Jesus. You'll start, who was Jesus really? You'll hear these kind of stories, or stories that attempt to debunk the resurrection or the passion narrative. You see them too, usually around December as we approach Christmas. But CNN with a piece, and CNN's not all bad. I mean, they've got some good, Tim Stanley, who writes for them, a devout Catholic I really appreciate, and Father James Martin, a Jesuit who writes for them. He's got a column in there from Saturday, Five Things You Didn't Know About Jesus, which I thought was interesting enough. One, Jesus came from a nowhere little town. Yes, from Nazareth, who was dismissed. In fact, that's the reason Nathanael dismissed him. Can anything good come from Nazareth? He sneers in John 1. Number two, Jesus probably didn't know everything. As he said, this is a thorny theological question. If Jesus is divine, wouldn't he know all things? But on the other hand, he had a human consciousness. He needed to be taught something before he could know it. So this is where, yeah, it is a thorny theological question, this issue of you've got his human nature and his divine nature. The third one is Jesus was tough. He was somebody who worked as a carpenter, a craftsman, without power tools. Number four, Jesus, this was the one I wanted to quibble with a little bit. Number five, Jesus didn't want to die. That's true. If you read what happens in Gethsemane and his entire even physical stature coming under assault as he prays and ultimately yields, not my will, but yours be done. But this fourth one that he mentions, I want to take a little quibble with, and that's that Jesus needed me time. As he writes here, the Gospels frequently speak of Jesus' need to withdraw from crowds and even his disciples. Today, by the Sea of Galilee, where Jesus carried out much of his ministry, you can see how close the towns were, he writes, how natural it would have been for the enthusiastic crowds to press in on him, just as the Gospels describe. There's even a cave on the shoreline not far from Capernaum, his base of operations, where he may have prayed. It's called the Eremos Cave, from the word for desolate or solitary, which we get the word hermit from. Even though Jesus was the Son of God, he needed time alone in prayer with the Father. So this is where I would quibble, right? Did Jesus really need me time, or did Jesus need us time? Jesus needed time with the Father. If anything, if you read the Gospels, and particularly the Gospel of John, the intimacy of Jesus the Son with the Father is at the core of his ministry, the core of his own self-identity. And if anything, you know, we use that phrase me time a lot. Believe me, I have a crowded house. Seven children. Actually, now we only have five living at home with us, but about, you know, less than 2,000 square feet. We're on top of each other. Sometimes I can appreciate, yeah, you know, sometimes I don't mind hopping in the car for a drive. I work for the Catholic Diocese. We're pretty broad geographically, so sometimes I get in my car for an hour or two. Me time. I get it. But we need, just as our Lord needed, more than me time. We need us time with the Father, or the beautiful thing for us, being drawn into the circle of life and love, who are the Trinity. We enter into that eternal communion of life and love, who is the source of all life, of all strength, and all grace. There's that great definition of the Trinity. God himself, this is from the Catechism, God himself is an eternal exchange of love, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. And he has destined us to share in that exchange. Through our baptism, we are drawn in to the beauty of that communion. Without that us time, without that time to be drawn in and to pray and to simply be silent even in the presence of such love, we will find ourselves woefully inadequate to love as he calls us to love. I think I'll have to get into this topic tomorrow, remembering what serves what. Just something that I've had on my mind a lot lately is how the church has a lot of institutional machinery. Now, it's a natural thing. I mean, it's part of the fact that we believe in a visible church. Organization, institutions, they're good things. The people who say they're against the institutional church, I was one of the also against institutional education or institutional health care. I mean, human beings, we make institutions. That's what we do. Even, you know, evangelical communities that grow up with an anti-institutional ethos quickly find themselves, as they grow, needing an organizational structure, surprise, surprise. And they begin to look like the very institutions they once rejected. So I'm not coming from an anti-institution bent, but sometimes the institutional machinery of the church, we can forget that the institutional machinery serves to facilitate the mission of the church as opposed to being an end in itself. And I think it's a particular problem that we have as Catholics, having 2,000 years worth of institutional machinery that we have to be very mindful of. So maybe we'll get back into this a little bit more tomorrow. Let's spin up the Dollar Catechism wheel. We'll go to random.org, our random number generator, see what we can spin up. Number between 1 and 2865, told them in paragraphs in the Catechism. Whole bunch of truth. We'll see where Providence helps us land. Knowing, of course, that truth is never random, but always integrated within the panoramic totality of the faith. 1749 is the number. This is about freedom. Freedom makes man a moral subject. When he acts deliberately, man is, so to speak, the father of his acts. Human acts, that is, acts that are freely chosen in consequence of a judgment of conscience, can be morally evaluated. They are either good or evil. Wow, I never thought of it in terms of the father of his acts. Well, there's a lot to unpack, particularly after I just binge-watched Better Call Saul. Because here's the thing, we make decisions, and we don't always think about the moral decisions that we make and what their long-lasting implications and ramifications may be. Just as we bring a child into the world with no guarantee of who that child will be or what that child will become, our moral acts become our children with a mind and a life sometimes of their own. That should give us pause before we make decisions, because the freedom we've been given is a great privilege. But as Spider-Man's uncle said, with great power comes great responsibility. Anyway, more tomorrow by God's grace. Go Zags. I'll predict, let's see, just for the fun of it, Gonzaga 79, North Carolina 75. We'll see you in the morning. This is the Mike Allen Show.
Listening to Breadbox Media Podcasts. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.